Welcome to The Choice. This is Kurt Doolittle.
Episode 5, Introducing the End of History, European and Jewish Elites and Their Opposing Strategies.
This is a re-recording of Episode 2. It's slightly longer with more detail and possibly better organized. The end of history is a political and philosophical proposition that a particular political, economic, and social system may constitute the endpoint in humanity's socio-economic evolution and the final form of human government. Knowing the end of history would require the discovery of the natural laws of human cooperation from the interpersonal to the political, and their explanation of history and the prediction of the future, just as the discovery of the first laws of the physical universe would provide an explanation of the history and future of the physical universe. This is because both physical and natural laws should be finite. In other words, there's only so many existential laws we can find, but even if what we can do with those laws once we know them might be infinite. In future episodes of The Choice, I'll try to explain that we had achieved the end of history over a century ago, and unfortunately hostile parties are trying to reverse our achievement. In today's episode, we'll discover history as the masculine civilization's domestication of animal man and the feminine civilization's resistance movements against it. This discussion will introduce you to one of the great cycles of history and the competition between civilizations and their strategies. And now, as I said, I'd use a present example. In a recent release of The Portal, Eric Weinstein interviews yet another guest, and together they engage in eloquent and articulate gossip, moralizing and psychologizing. I certainly enjoy it, about the current state of affairs, and this is really Eric's mode of default speech. I can sympathize because he talks over his audience all the time, just as he talked over whatever group that they call themselves. And we've seen him do this, or we have seen this method of moralizing and psychologizing about, you know, about the state of affairs with his other guests, including his brother Brett, Tyler Cohen, and Sam Harris, and even Anna Kachian. And they continue this tradition, which we saw in Mencius Moldbug's gossiping, psychologizing, and moralizing. And I'll take it further and say that the reason for the failure of conservatism over the years, especially over the 20th century, was likewise its entrapment in gossiping, moralizing, and psychologizing instead of solving any material problems. Now, it's pretty easy to appear intelligent by making articulate complaints, yet never providing existentially and operationally possible and equally criticizable solutions to problems. Criticizing by gossip, shaming, ridiculing, moralizing, and psychologizing is a form of self-indulgent self-congratulation by people who really are quite articulate and well-read, but haven't earned any position of influence, no position of responsibility, no position of accountability, and produced no solutions subject to equal criticism. You notice people who do achieve those positions tend to propose solutions and talk about how to operate them. They don't talk about the motivations, psychology, or morals of the people involved in what they're trying to change. They might simply explain their incentives and where they're making errors, but they don't gossip, shame, ridicule, moralize, and signal virtue and superiority. Now, gossiping, shaming, ridiculing, moralizing, and psychologizing emotionally endears an equally incompetent audience that doesn't possess the knowledge necessary to come up with an alternative solution. And in this case, generally, what we're gossiping, shaming, and ridiculing, and moralizing about is the fact that people have been demanded to conform to high-trust European ethics that makes their range of choices and the virtue signaling they demonstrate with them possible. I mean, if you can't write a project plan, a contract, a law and its regulations and procedures, and a constitution, you're generally just talking trash. Whether in his academic research or his criticism of the academy, Eric never puts forward solutions other than what I consider the typical female or Marxist. If I was in charge of communism, it would work. Well, it won't work, no matter who's in charge, and I'm quite sure Eric would fail if he was in charge, because if he had a plan, he would state it. And people like Eric who have tried to be in charge have always failed. His recommendation is that if we had better people, if we had better humans, if we got our heads together. This is all female speak, which is translatable to, you know, I'm smart and I have confidence and these guys are wrong, but I don't know how to do it. But if we get the men in the room, we can encourage them to come up with something, or it's code for consensus building in small groups within the radius of empathy and has nothing at all to do with the hierarchy, duty, and rules necessary to run large-scale organizations. This is what I consider the ignorant dinner gossip circles and unaccomplished academics say, not men of adversarial achievement and the organization and operation and accomplishment of a vast body of people at various abilities and ranks using limited resources to maintain a competitive advantage in their quality of life over time. Instead, all underlying problems of politics are always the same. Human organizations always follow incentives to evolve toward the maximum internal rent-seeking until the system is unable to adapt to shocks, innovations, changes in trade routes, immigration, conquest, or war. Should have added conversion in there. And it's people like Eric who use the same technique that bloated those institutions with their non-European sense-making and strategy in violation of European sense-making strategy that had prohibited that behavior. Because it's people who think if only people like me were in charge, they would not fail to avoid following those same incentives. Instead, the Western solution in all things is to create competitive adversarial markets that suppress the malincentives in order for individuals to survive despite those malincentives. And the West is the only population to do this in history because the only people in human history to develop via negativa markets for the punishment of the seizure of opportunities for reward using those malincentives and by doing so by using rule of all applicable to all. So Eric, like everyone else, illustrates the imaginations of women and those without responsibility and the civilizations that all failed, like the Jewish civilization and Islamic civilization, develop formal institutions that suppress the seizure of malincentives through adversarial markets under the law's threat of punishment that is decided by empirical evidence instead of consensus and that art of discourse the Jews are fond of calling dialectic and social construction, but the scientific description of sophistry and idealism by those who can afford to be sophomoric and ideal because there are men of achievement and empirical reasoning somewhere running the place. The Jewish culture is governed like a prayer group or knitting circle, which is why they can't survive without host men to produce a society that they can parasitically survive upon despite their feminine cognition and social structure and absolute failure throughout history to develop masculine reason, empiricism, adversarialism, warranty for one's words, rule of law and institutions, and of course, European sense-making in realism, naturalism, operationalism. There is a reason the Jews always fail and are always cast out. It's because they practice the female group strategy of parasitism on male manufactured order and commons until they accumulate sufficient capital from having done so to attempt to replace those empirical male commons and institutions with socially constructed parasitic female commons, and the population rebels. Now let's talk about the masculine versus the feminine. Because every group relies on a group strategy, a mythology to explain it, a set of paradigms and grammars to teach, argue, and enforce it. There are only three ways of coercing humans, so the spectrum of human strategies varies from the male violent and threat of punishment to the masculine trade versus loss of opportunity, and the female undermining and threat of ostracization. And by giving different weights to each, individuals and groups compete. It's rather obvious why females and males evolve to specialize in their particular strategies. The strong fight, the not as strong trade, and the weak undermine and ostracize. Female means of control is by baiting. They seduce children, other women, and men with promises of affection, care, assistance and sex on the one hand, and the threat of losing those goods on the other, and the use of false promise to bait as many possible into her control, delivering somewhere between what she can and as little as possible so that they serve her at the lowest cost to her. The purpose of gossip is to produce consensus on demands between those lacking agency, so that those with agency will be forced to satisfy them. In other words, academics and public intellectuals, gossip, ridicule, moralize, psychologize, rally, and shame because they don't inspire or accumulate loyalty, don't accumulate or inspire force, don't have anything to offer, don't have anything to trade, and so they're left with one weapon of influence, and that's disapproval and undermining by gossiping, shaming, and moralizing, as if they were somehow depriving us, like the female, of sex, care, and affection, when all they and other gossips are doing is demanding that they be satisfied, or they'll continue to devote their energy to continuous undermining. Those that have agency, well, they don't gossip. They use factual arguments because they have agency. It's a general rule. Rulers rule. Philosophers complain about them, and theologians undermine them. Now, he doesn't grasp that the pride he holds in the Jewish body of thought is pride in the Jewish adoption of the female strategy of undermining masculine empires from within by the combination of sophistry, which goes by the name of pilpul, undermining, which goes by the name of critique, Marxist critique, strawmanning, plus the techniques of gossiping, ridiculing, rallying, moralizing, psychologizing, what we call GSRRM, or what also includes two other tactics that are common, empty strawmanning and heaping of undue praise, which is the opposite of strawmanning. Where strawmanning is criticizing Western civilization as oppressive rather than domesticating and civilizing, and using heaping of undue praise and personalization. So what you'll see is this person is really virtuous and did all these things when this person's merely an example of people who contributed to an idea. Or conversely, as we see in the technique of trying to personalize a movement and criticize an individual on behalf of the movement. They personalize the current president, for example, as the center of the movement because they can't address or they won't address the group of people who voted for them directly. Eric doesn't grasp that the pride he holds in the Jewish body of thought is pride in the Jewish adoption of the female strategy of undermining masculine empires from within by the combination of sophistry, or what we call pilpul, undermining, what we call critique, strawmanning and gossiping, shaming, ridiculing, moralizing, psychologizing. I'm repeating all those tactics, but we usually just shorten it to GSRRM. And the empty strawmanning, which means criticizing Western civilization as oppressive rather than civilizing, and their collective inability to develop systems by which people operate large organizations by loyalty, empirical evidence, and rules, including law, legislation, regulation, and procedure. And that this is the reason Jews accomplished precisely nothing before Europeans apparently foolishly granted opportunity to integrate in during the Industrial Revolution. Even so, the Ashkenazi used the technique Eric is using of false promise, baiting into hazard with pilpul and critique, and invented the pseudosciences of undermining our civilization using their anti-Darwinian female reproductive strategy, female means of undermining in the absence of creativity by Bose in anthropology, Freud in psychology, Marx in economics and sociology, Adorno and Fromm in neo-Marxism, meaning, or what we call cultural Marxism, in culture and aesthetics, Betty Friedan's anti-male Western feminism, Rand and Rothbard's denial of demand for the state to suppress the spectrum of parasitism and their anti-rule of law and anti-statism, Derrida's postmodernism, which denies truth and restores female social construction, and the denial of Darwinian differences, what we call human biodiversity denialism or political correctness, then their fostering of immigration and multiculturalism and their advocacy of and specialization and parasitic financialization, all of which were achieved by social construction, meaning propaganda, pseudoscience, sophistry, meaning pilpul, undermining, meaning critique, that destroyed the system of rules that made European civilization possible. First, or A, militarization of the polity, wherein all people have status and merit regardless of economic status, as long as they do their duty. B, all people must demonstrate buy-in by participation in the military defense, demonstrating that they will do their duty. C, causing them to demonstrate ownership and investment in the polity and therefore defend it. D, and earning the right to have their differences adjudicated by sovereignty and reciprocity of tort or property. And that's all that's possible between sovereigns, and therefore producing a market in all aspects of life at the cost, or is a cost, of suppressing the reproduction of those unable or unwilling or untrained to compete in that market on the terms of that market, the natural law of reciprocity. And lastly, devoting the surplus to the production of commons, commons that no other civilization managed to produce, and which are the reason the West can form large voluntary organizations, including military, political, social, economic, and familial, and why other civilizations can't. So I thought I'd use a few minutes to explain the strategy, paradigm, and logic they're using in the discussion to illustrate the difference between European and Ashkenazi thought and Jewish thought in general, and in doing so, explain not only the crisis of the current age, but the crisis of the past, from the Roman fall to the wars of religion to the world wars to our present crisis. As Europeans, us, we sought to reharmonize, restore the sense-making in our traditional law, our military order, and our martial group strategy in that law and military order, with the various literary, philosophical, and theological attempts to undermine and destroy that strategy, and why. Now, coming into adulthood, listening to Eric, we see he's part of the first generation of Ashkenazi that are experiencing what every child does when he or she realizes that their parents weren't so dim after all, and that they might have been right. But they're afraid to admit it, or they're embarrassed to do so, and they're certainly embarrassed to say so. And they're afraid to thank and embarrassed to thank their parents. In this case, because the Ashkenazi are a parasitic people dependent on host populations for defense, commons, markets, and resources. And those parents, therefore, would be European aristocracy and their military, legal, and empirical sense-making and traditions. Like the French who begin the counter-enlightenment against the Anglo-Restoration of empiricism, the French were followed by the Germans, Russians, Chinese, Hindus, and Muslims, the Ashkenazi are just the most recent group that's gone through the counter-revolution against European sense-making, where European sense-making consists of realism, naturalism, operationalism, testimonial truth, and reciprocity, and the result producing competitive adversarial markets, or in simple terms, duels, in every aspect of life. Duels being important because they do not require third parties to adjudicate them. This duel, or this adversarialism, is consistent throughout our society. It's why we ended up with rule of law. But instead, the Ashkenazi have doubled down on their use of baiting into hazard, myth seduction, pill-pull, sophistry, critique, undermining, social construction, propaganda, out-group parasitism upon the productivity of others, and in-group socialism. This is the only group that managed to construct their competitive strategy on the evolutionary strategy of the human female against human males. The difference is that the Ashkenazi had their internal reaction outward toward hosts, as their strategy would predict, of course, instead of inward, and so they failed to reform and instead used their expertise in pill-pull and critique and social construction and propaganda to destroy the sense-making of Germany, Russia, the USA, and now Europe from within, just as females undermined one another or dominant males from within. The Ashkenazi destroyed sense-making across Eurasia because they never needed to pay the price for not doing so. They could blame others for failing to adopt their strategy. But instead, if they had all returned to Israel, so they could pay the price of failing to adapt to that reality, which in turn requires, if you desire European quality of life, you must also adopt realism, naturalism, operationalism, testimony, reciprocity, markets, and limiting reproduction to those who succeed in those markets, instead of a socially constructed alternate reality that cannot survive without a host polity providing the European model of thought and its commons. The same is true of African Americans, and the same is true of Hispanic Americans. The same is true now of Muslim Americans. All people double down on their strategy, because instead of forcing integration into European sense-making and its realism, naturalism, operationalism, testimonial truth, reciprocity, markets, and our limiting of reproduction to those who succeed in those markets, we allowed the post-war Jewish thought leadership to migrate from Eastern Europe, the Soviet Union, and Germany, especially the German Jews, to Columbia University in New York, to repeat their strategy of undermining host peoples by using temporary post-war prosperity, the gullibility of the first generation of families off the farm, or the first generation into home ownership, combined with new media, the academy, the flooding of the academy with pseudoscience and sophistry to sell to them, and overloading the institution of democracy, which is only useful for choosing priorities in a homogeneous society, and instead using it to undermine undermine the integration and thereby create frictions that are only resolvable by authority. Then they used the African underclass, as the Soviets had used the Russian peasantry, as an excuse to provide the Jews with justification for non-integration themselves and to relocate the African Americans from farm communities, interrupting their development of norms, traditions, and middle class thought leadership, resulting in the destruction of the African family and the African American sub-civilization and the destruction of American cities by loading them with what are effectively hostiles to stack the democratic deck, just as the Russians had relocated peasants to Eastern Europe to undermine European culture, create people who would report on them and who would drag the civilization downward so it would be more easily controlled. And they got away with this organized crime by shaming high-trust European Christian majorities into overextending our Christian charity, just as we, the Romans and the Greeks, had done by overextending our empires. They shamed us into false promise, baiting our people into the hazard, the group strategy of females that we're most vulnerable to. And we, meaning Europeans who conquered, founded, built, and settled this country because of our tradition of sovereignty, market reciprocity, noblesse oblige, and Christian charity, tolerated this heresy against our sense-making under the false presumption that these less domesticated people would, quote, mature and learned. But they don't. They didn't. They never do. They can't. People never abandon their sense-making unless they abandon the strategy that their sense-making evolved to persist. And European sense-making, that sense-making that dragged mankind out of ignorance, poverty, and suffering in the ancient and modern worlds, is intolerable to the Jewish, Muslim, Hispanic, many Catholic, some Russian, most Hindu, and all Chinese. It's intolerable to all but the Japanese and Korean peoples, who appear to be our only equally domesticated peers and who don't seek to come to the West because of their equal domestication. They just don't need to. Conversely, all non-European immigrants that migrate to the West are demonstrated evidence of the failures of self-domestication, the failure of their people's sense-making, and the failure of the strategy that they persist with that sense-making. Yet all peoples who migrate from less domesticated, less successful civilizations resist Western sense-making. That is, they only adopt Western sense-making if they are capable of it or forced by mandatory integration into it, which means if they are from the upper middle classes of professionals for whom adversarial markets serve their own interests, they can somewhat integrate, since education worldwide and empirical reasoning is de facto indoctrination into European sense-making. So, diversity always and everywhere creates demand for authority, and authority creates demand, stagnation, and maladaption. Well, that's except in two circumstances that warrant the exercise of authority: the modernization of a backward people, or B, the warfare to defend them. In other words, when the market doesn't need to continuously calculate opportunities using disparate volumes of knowledge because the threats are obvious and efforts have to be temporarily directed to either defense or modernization. The Chinese succeeded at the long-term expansion because they're severely intolerant and pessimistic. Europeans, on the other hand, succeeded at rapid change because, given our history as homogeneous peoples, we are irrationally tolerant and optimistic. When instead the optimum strategy is Chinese demand for conformity in pursuit of continuous harmony on one end, and European rule of law and sense-making on the other in pursuit of maximization of continuous adaptation and seizure of opportunity. In future episodes of The Choice, I'll cover the spectrums of sense-making and what I call the grammars as paradigms, vocabularies, and logics of group strategies. Knowledge of the grammars is to psychology and social science as the periodic table of elements is to chemistry, and about as equally explanatory. Now, universal sense-making, in other words, each group has its own sense-making, but universal sense-making is possible at the cost of universal adoption of realism, naturalism, operationalism, testimonial truth before faced regardless of cost to self or others, reciprocity regardless of cost to self, and limiting one's reproduction to those who can pay for it by success in the markets regardless of cost to self, so that the proceeds of our market success can be devoted to the production of returns on sustainable commons. This is the answer to the great question of history. the world has reacted against the Indo-European expansion and the Chinese expansion because that cost to self is impossible for others because the heterogeneity of populations outside the two insular homogeneous peoples on the West Europeans on the East Asians is impossible. That is history. Everything else in history depends on this underlying conflict between the two externally self-domesticating peoples because of their homogeneity and the internally non-domesticating peoples because of their heterogeneity. In other words, diversity is about the worst possible thing that can happen to a people. The 19th and 20th century spectrum of Ashkenazi pseudosciences all share in common that they're revolts against the European sense-making because they are revolts against the male eugenic strategy, which is in turn hostile to the female dysgenic strategy, and as such, these 20th century pseudosciences are together a counter-revolution not just against Western civilization, but against Darwin and Darwin's explanation for the success of European and East Asian civilizations. And they illustrate the failure of every other civilization to fully nationalize so that people are willing to pay the cost of suppression of reproduction of those outside the market and the market's continuation of natural selection as the continued domestication and transcendence of man by the most humane means possible and the one subject to no external choice. In other words, only nations have the genetic interest to self-domesticate, globalists don't, and as such they're a threat to mankind, and as well as the more developed agents of mankind. So if there is an end of history and it can exist, that's it. The need for domestication by eugenics and continued transcendence. Now I'm going to try to put a point on it. European civilization, when practicing our group strategy, a strategy embedded in our traditional law and military tradition, just wasn't the first. We were out there on the edge of the Bronze Age. But we evolved and continued to evolve faster than the rest of mankind because, quite by accident, we discovered the fastest means of adaptation available to man. A universal militia, where the status, meaning respect, is available and earned by the fulfillment of duty regardless of one's station in the hierarchy, where every man in the hierarchy is sovereign before the law and jury of his peers, where disputes are resolved by the only mean possible between sovereigns, reciprocity, and as a result, the only means of organizing and cooperating are markets in all aspects of life, including those markets for self-domestication, including freedom, liberty, citizenship, and governance by demonstration of incremental ability and loyalty to the group by success in those markets. And then under the social order, no man's constrained by experimenting with innovation. In fact, it's heroic. He can move if he's able. And conversely, the first time a crime is committed, which is a failure in experimenting and doing the opposite of what's good, the first time the crime is brought before the court, it's suppressed by the court. It doesn't require any authority or approval or process. If you committed a crime of irreciprocity, it goes on the books under the common law, and society immediately and continuously adapts to both identify and distribute beneficial opportunities in the market and to suppress harmful opportunities in the negative market we call the law. And those that can't keep up end up being wards of the citizens responsible for them, whether parent clan, priesthood, or in some cases state. The West doesn't need to be first. It never mattered that we were first because we always adapted the fastest. It doesn't matter who discovers something first if you can't make use of it. So the West didn't need to be first. We were always fastest, and as fastest, we'll always have a competitive advantage, and always having competitive advantage, we'll have more prosperity per person, particularly since surpluses can be directed to the production of commons rather than increases in numbers of dependents upon the productive who prevent the investment in commons. This advantage is paid for by the cost of truth before face, reciprocity and nationalism, and suppression of reproduction of those who can't fit. That sacrifice for reproduction is null if one is cared for because one's kin produce one's bloodlines, but also take care of you. So you sacrifice reproduction in exchange for care by not passing on the harm that your bloodline is creating against the people. This process domesticates man just like every other animal. There's no magic to it. Now, despite European civilization's success in just a few centuries in the ancient and modern worlds by dragging mankind kicking and screaming out of superstition, ignorance, hard labor, poverty, starvation, disease, suffering, early death, and the vicissitudes of a nature all but hostile to our existence, and frankly having given us only a window of just over 10,000 years of respite without trying to kill us more frequently, the Academy is inundated by anti-European sense-making that inhibits every single discipline, and even including mathematical physics. Much more so economics and the social sciences, which are most affected by the Ashkenazi pseudoscientific revolution against European group strategy and its eugenics by using critique, just as we were affected by the Jewish supernatural revolution in the ancient world's revolt against the Greco-Roman's domestication of man by the same use of pill-pull, sophistry, and critique undermining. And like the old world's false promise of sophistry and supernaturalism, these were sold to those most susceptible to the female strategy of baiting into hazard false promise using sophistry and undermining women, slaves, and the underclasses who were being domesticated. In the present era, the Academy is financed by false promises of freedom from physical, natural, market, and evolutionary laws under the pretense that the windfall of the restoration of European sense-making in the scientific revolution would lead to perpetual growth like a technological Garden of Eden, when instead it's led to uncontrolled growth like a cancer that kills the European host's sense-making. It doesn't seem to occur to Eric or his people that despite the genetic composition, intuition for the feminine strategy, cultural training in implying the female strategy, and indoctrination of a culture dependent upon that female strategy, that the reason he makes fewer errors than did Cantor, Bohr, or Einstein is that his study of geometry did for him what Descartes did for Europe, which was to restore mathematical thought from Platonism to operations, and return of it from its failure in Platonism, where words are descriptive but not causal. Mathematics, by its nature, is purely descriptive and not causal. We have to choose whether we're going to treat it as causal and a system of measurement, or descriptive and not. One can practice mathematics as language and verbal logic, or one can practice it as geometry and measurement as an engineering. Eric's intuition is an attempt, one I share, to re-Europeanize the Judaification of mathematics by Cantor, Bohr, and Einstein, and the host of people that undermined the foundation of mathematics with set logic of language instead of the operational logic of measurement, a warning that was issued by no less than Lawrence Poincaré, Hilbert, Brewer, Bridgman, and restored by those in computer science, but not mathematics. A difference best illustrated by the contrast between Cantor's infinities and Babbage's computer. In Cantor's imaginary verbalism, multiple infinities exist and are of different sizes. For Babbage's existential measurement, different gears produce pairing off at different rates. So under realism, naturalism, and operationalism, the Western sense-making, there are no such things as multiple infinities. There is but one concept of infinity, meaning we don't know the limit or the limit doesn't matter, but there are no possible unlimited operations, and pairing off using different ratio operations produces result sets at different rates. In other words, Cantor Platonized mathematics by removing the dimension of time. Let's put an even finer point on the assault on European sense-making. At the moment, the physics community is working with a series of ideas, loops, spinners, twisters, strings, variations on the waveform, without solving the underlying question of what geometry would produce such twists, spins, and vibrations, and allow such waves. Instead of asking the more obvious question, given the human brain works by a certain strategy, the three-dimensional simulation games that mimic it, proteins and molecules and the elements, are all forced to use pretty primitive geometry, why wouldn't the structure of the universe rely on the same kind of primitive geometry? In other words, why aren't waves the result of an underlying geometry? Well, as Eric's demonstrating by his appeals, the Academy can't go there because the current gated institutional narrative due to the history of ether theories and the history of unified field theories, as Eric has discussed, has cast this subject as a supernatural taboo, which seems rather odd when, if anything, magical fields in infinite space would be the supernatural outlier among all other theories in the rest of the sciences. So one could easily argue that the study of waveforms, rather than what might have produced them, has wasted most of the past century, and that, as Hayek predicted, and I tend to observe, the 20th in all but a few disciplines was a return to what he called mysticism, what I would call pseudoscience, pseudo-mathematics, and sophistry, and what contemporaries would call woo-woo. So we can also see a very obvious difference between, say, Gerhard Duft and Roger Penrose and the younger generation that has all but lost European sense-making because of the collapse of European sense-making in the academy by the conquest of the European candidate by non-European sense-making. Now, why is that? Well, Europeans testify. This is why it's more interesting to listen to people from some cultures than Europeans, because what's happening is we are raised to testify in all things. We are so indoctrinated in this particular process, we can't see it in all things. We say men speak in facts, but what we mean is men testify. So Europeans testify to observables, and Jews tell stories that convey meaning, and this is what our different cultures specialize in. The difference is that when put to work in competition, Europeans engineer in war, destroying physical commons, and Jews propagandize and undermine, destroying the informational and social commons. Europeans might very well be super predators, the male extreme that practices predation, but Jews are the female extreme, the social and informational super predator that practices parasitism on others' commons. Now, at present, we can't get enough information either by experimentation, observation, deduction, inference, or pure guesswork, and we've been working for a century with this top-down method of verbal investigation of the physical world, and at least current levels of energy, we appear to be at the limit of our investigation into the causes of those waveforms. When I suspect that, as we've seen elsewhere, and as we've seen rolling around for a bit now, but it seems stalled, the next step in the evolution of mathematics, which I assume Eric senses in more sophisticated form when he talks about symmetries in mathematics, economics, and physics, is the same one we see as generations of combinations in the physical world, from particles to atoms to molecules to proteins, and we see mathematically in the work of people like Conway, Mandelbrot, Wolfram, and others. But likewise, that seems to be going nowhere. Instead, the discovery today appears to be proceeding not in math or physics, where geometric combinatrics would provide insight, but it seems to be disinterested or stalled. I mean, I can't find many papers on it. But it happens instead in biology, in research on protein and RNA foldings, protein transitions that are mechanical, precisely because of this continued Platonism that's plaguing mathematics isn't used. In other words, the issue of waveforms doesn't arise, at least now that I think about it, it probably does, but it's not clouding our judgment. And so the foundations of the universe don't appear to be computable by points, which of necessity represent aggregates. We need the underlying geometry, and it certainly appears only calculable as geometries. If you've ever seen a child's snake puzzle, it has a series of like tetrahedrons that can only be rotated so many axes, forming so many shapes. This is a sort of real-world example of the kind of geometry that would produce the phenomena that we think of, spinners and twisters, etc., and strings. This toy remains the most likely analogy for the unified field, or something along, I mean, a field of this examples is, represents the unified field, meaning background that we model with waves, spinners, etc. So until we solve the question of the next mathematics of geometries by computational trial and error, we probably won't be able to represent it as descriptions with symbols. Now, this leads to a more interesting problem that I don't know if math as we understand it as human calculable symbols. In other words, I'm not sure that the past few centuries worth of the symbol of mathematics hasn't put us into a particular problem in itself, but if it is possible that human calculation ends there, limiting us to the mechanically computable, I suspect that probably won't be the case, because no matter what geometries we talk about, they will end up producing patterns that produce symmetries that are intermediate states that we can compare with each other and deduce from. My subtle point here, which is exacerbated in this rather long digression, is that people indoctrinated into hostile forms of sense-making, the paradigms and logics within them, and the group strategies that their sense-making persists, first of all, affect everything, and they can affect it profoundly negatively because, quite unfortunately to how the public desires it, people who scribble, their stuff rolls downhill. Intellectuals do have very great consequences over time. But groups who use these hostile forms of sense-making can be converted by first pointing out the criminality of their group strategy, next the means of sense-making that they use to construct their organized crimes, regardless of whether they are intentionally participating in their organized crime or they're mere carriers of intellectually infectious disease that destroy sense-making just as opiates destroy the brain's ability to regulate emotions. And that people can be trained to adapt to and integrate into European sense-making just as surely as we can teach reading, writing, arithmetic, and for that matter, in my business, the logic of operational natural law of reciprocity, as well as the extant crafts of programming geometry. And the fact that we're tolerating this organized crime against our informational commons, our normative and institutional commons, our civilization, and as a consequence, our genetic commons, well, you know, that's happening just because we don't forcibly integrate people into it anymore, and we tolerate this organized crime. Now, as for reforming it, well, we are talking about intellectuals. We can reform the academy, you know, any kind of pontification, no matter what public intellectual is putting it. It's as easy as reforming the rest of our civilization. There's nothing special about intellectuals. And all that reform requires that we restore European sense-making. Now, to restore European sense-making requires we restore truthful speech and the informational commons that we depend upon. We criminalize the suppression of truth by female undermining, using gossiping, shaming, shouting down, outraging, and whatever. We criminalize baiting into hazard with false promise, and then we can restore truthful speech and the compromised markets between genders, classes, and generations if we enforce perjury before the court with a vengeance. We don't do any of that today. We restore libel and slander and liability for harms. We need to restore that. That was a mistake. We extend the prohibition on false promise and commercial speech to political speech, and we criminalize false promise, baiting into hazard using the fictionalisms, these are spectrums, sophistry to idealism, divination to pseudo-mathematics, magic to pseudoscience, and occult to supernaturalism from all forms of speech in public to the public and matters public. In other words, those are three conditions that have to be met, and it's easy to tell the difference between when you're just out there talking nonsense or talking to friends, whatever, and you're out there getting paid or advocating for a particular political policy. Next, we'd have to criminalize voluntary alienation, meaning failure of taking responsibility for defense of the informational commons upon which all our sense-making depends, and we would have to restore prohibition on voluntary alienation of taking responsibility for the rest of the commons. Right now, we're just letting crime spiral. We'd have to enumerate rather than apply our group strategy in the Constitution, something again I've done. We'd have to complete the enumeration of our rights and responsibilities in the Constitution under that group strategy, something I've done. We'd have to enumerate rather than apply the means of jurisprudence in the Constitution, which I've done, and require strict construction of law from first principles stating original intent and a few other properties, which I've done. And we would have to deprive the court of legislation from the bench by demanding return of the undecidable to the legislatures. And all of those issues, that's the only difficult one. Now, my work, my movement's work, is reducible to the restoration of European sense-making, and with it, the restoration of truth and the informational commons, the elimination of fraud from legislation by restoration of empiricism and testimony and liability in government, the depoliticization of the polity as a consequence. Most importantly for everyone in practical terms is the definancialization of the economy that preys upon our people, which has caused our decline in reproduction especially against our most talented, then the restoration of the intergenerational family, the civil society, and the rewards of the continued value of European civilization to mankind in the transcendence of man from domesticated animal to the gods we imagine. Now, what we do with all that is up to us. But at least for the European men among us, we won't go quietly into the night as did our Roman ancestors. We've had one dark age brought upon us by mass migration and Middle Eastern false promise, and we won't tolerate another. So, you know, fool us once with fraud of false promise and shame on you. Fool us again with the fraud of false promise. Well, shame on us. We're kind of tired right now of being shamed for having dragged mankind out of ignorance, poverty, superstition, hard labor, starvation, disease, suffering, early death, and the vicissitudes of nature, and the thanklessness of others for having done so just because we did it poorly, when we could have just as easily instead eradicated, enslaved, and serfed them as the Jewish people did to the Russians. Now, we are coming very close to having the bloodiest civil and revolutionary war in human history because of the Ashkenazi destruction of European sense-making, our institutions, and our culture, the same assault on sense-making that destroyed the ancient worlds and destroyed Germany and Russia and now us. In closing, please expect a few rather obvious habits in this podcast. First, I handle the taboo subjects, as you've just seen. I think I handle them as prosecutions under the law. I think that I do a pretty good job of them. They're still unpleasant and uncomfortable for people. That doesn't mean they're false. The fact that it's uncomfortable probably means it's true. Next, I use a lot of terms you might be familiar with if you've studied mathematics, the philosophy of science, philosophy, economics, law, and history. In other words, propertarian law is a graduate-level thing, and it's an interdisciplinary method that requires a great deal of knowledge from across the spectrum. Fundamentally, the things you need to understand about it, though, the Constitution and what we're trying to do with it, how people lie and how people speak the truth and what reciprocity consists of, these are all pretty much school-level things that we can teach to anybody. The methodology behind it, well, it's quite complicated. You don't need to know all that. If you are an infovore like me or a super geek like a lot of the people who are in the movement, we can give you the reading lists and supporting materials, and you can follow us and you can learn it. But for most of you, you just need either, one, look the stuff up on Google, look it up on the website by using the search bar, or look up or ask us what a term means in context. I mean, we love to answer questions because it makes our people better at teaching. Now, third, I use a lot of serializations. That means lists of terms, and I repeat them over and over again. This kind of using lists prevents the problem of what we call ideal types, Platonism, and it leads to conflation and sophistry and all sorts of confusion and deceit. It's actually where most deceit in argument comes from, is the tendency to be able to use a term that has a broad spectrum of meanings to imply things that don't in the context. Well, our methodology in the law turns terms into measurements. In other words, they have very specific meanings, and the way we use these very specific meanings is by essentially drawing a line and putting all the terms in a row. And this is what we call disambiguates the terms and puts them in series so you understand which one of them we're using and why. Habitually repeating these things is how we teach people how to use them. I realize that it's helpful if these series of terms are on screen, but perhaps other people in the movement will add a video or screenshots to this podcast. I don't really have the time. I don't have the time to do this already. Fourth, most people suggest you need to listen or read my work multiple times to understand it. This is because I weave together a lot of ideas into a competition. So just as I put terms in line, what it means we put them in competition with each other so that we know they're disambiguated. The second thing is that, you know, the story of 2 points make a line, but 3 points test a line? Well, if you have like 6 or 7 terms and they're all in order, it gets very hard to misinterpret what that means. The same thing happens when we use ideas competing against each other. So I weave together ideas in the competitions, usually across civilizations, across time and examples, to show that something isn't unique. It's a general process out there in the world. So that's why I weave together these ideas. Anyway, thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.